Back together again, you and I, for a busy show. Monday, January 23rd, 2023, on Connecticut Today, we featured a vibrant discussion about whether or not home insurance companies operating in Connecticut can deny or raise rates on liability coverage based on a breed of dog that may reside in a particular home. Quinnipiac University School of Law Tax Clinic Director Sarah Spodek talked about day one of the 2023 tax season. Lawyer, author, and police advocate Lance LaRusso updated us on the latest nationwide issues confronting law enforcement. And finally, our buddy Eric Open from the Connecticut Hockey Foundation talked about that group's annual fundraising activities. You know, generally, people love their pets, right? We all love our pets. If we have our pets now, if we at one time had pets, if we in the future will continue to have pets. I had a cat growing up back when I was partially owner of a condo and a house when I was married. We had a dog and a couple of cats. So the pets that walk and slither and swim and climb among us, we have a unique relationship with them. I firmly believe that, you know, pets can communicate with each other. I've always thought that. I think pets understand a lot more than we give them credit for. And I think we'll, in the afterlife, maybe find out that our dog or our cat will come up to us in the afterlife and say, "Yes, you idiot, when you were talking about X, Y, and Z, of course I understood you." Oh, you did? Yes. Meow. Woof. But we still have to understand that they're pets. They're not human. It doesn't mean we can't care for them compassionately. We can't love them as a member of the family. Lord knows when a long-running pet in a family, usually a dog or dogs or a cat or cats, when they pass away, I mean, it hurts. Especially if you've had that pet for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. If, you know, that pet was the only other thing in the house when you got married, before you got kids. If that pet was part of the family gatherings or every minute of every day when you left for work or came home in the afternoon or at night from school or work, ready to greet you with, usually as pets do, unconditional love. You know, feed them, take them out, play with them every so often. And generally our pets are there. And our pets are good animals. Animals are animals. They do not, at least as far as we know, the vast majority of them, there are some pretty, we're finding out more and more, there are some intelligent, quote-unquote, pets, dolphins, we're finding out how intelligent crows are now. Crows can actually play games with human beings. You know, there are certain breeds of dogs that are more intelligent than other. A border collie. I read something the other night that a border collie basically has the intelligence of a 5 or 6 year old kid and can know a couple of hundred words and understand what those words mean and respond to you. But basically, animals are animals. They work by instinct. There are certain cues, particularly in dog breeds. There are certain cues that, for whatever reason, make dogs act aggressively. I think we can all understand that. Doesn't make them bad. It doesn't mean that one dog is inherently worse than the other, all things being raised, right? They're all God's creatures. I think we can understand that. But there is a bill now, and again, I start again with a piece of legislation that's not getting too much buzz, but could affect a lot of people here. You know, previously, last week and the week before, we talked about a bill that would allow bars to stay open till 4 in the morning. Okay, that would affect a lot of people. We talked about a bill that would let kids as young as 12 years old, you know, decide their vaccination status. Yeah, a lot of people emotional about that. We talked about a bill that strictly for the sake of diversity, quote unquote, to make everybody feel better, would lower some of the physical standards that are demanded of a female firefighter, not for any specific safety, but to make everybody feel better who wants a more diverse workforce. Now we have this bill, and it's got advocates and opponents and proponents on both sides of the aisle. There is a bill. Now, get this for you dog owners and you renters and you landlords. This is interesting. There is a bill being floated in Hartford right now, and who knows if this will ever come out of committee or to a committee vote, or will the committee here that it falls under, will it be tabled here because it just causes too much agita? This bill would require insurance companies to provide equal coverage to dog owners. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? Here's the essential question. And it's spelled out here in the Connecticut News Junkie, Hugh McQuaid's story in the Connecticut News Junkie. So listen up. If you are a renter or you are a homeowner, but you have coverage, right, that includes, coverage in case one of your dogs bites someone or attacks someone. Should the owner of a pit bull or a Rottweiler be denied a renter's insurance policy or have to pay more in premiums from a homeowner policy? Such practices would be prohibited in Connecticut under a bill before the legislature's Insurance and Real Estate Committee. So again, there's a bill here that would prevent the insurance company from saying, hey, you own a pit bull. You own a Rottweiler. There are numbers here. And this is the crux of the story. Are we letting our emotions, because we love our pets, we love our dogs, we love our pit bulls, we love our Presser Canarios, we love our Rottweilers, we love them. Does that in any way, cloud the fact that for reasons we can't understand, those dogs are often more aggressive than others. And they just are. Now, your Rottweiler, your pit bull, your Doberman, they may have the countenance of a sheep. They may be the sweetest, most lovable, protective dog when they're around you. And that's fine. But you cannot deny that they snap. And every year we hear of three or four instances. In fact, there were a couple nationwide. Some infant just got mauled by, I think it was one or two pit bulls that were allowed to roam free. Now, you can peel back all the layers here and saying, number one, the dog should have never been let to roam free. I agree. Number two, how were the dogs raised? That does have a lot to do with genetic imprinting. Were those dogs from a line of dogs that was raised for fighting? May have been bred for fighting, bred from the time it popped out of their mother to be aggressive and other dogs and people. I get that. And those are all valid questions. But now we're going to tell the insurance companies that they can't set their rates based on what they may have to pay out if a homeowner or a renter has a dog that strip the emotion away from it, has a dog that is documented to be a dangerous breed. I know a lot of people don't like to hear about this. They don't. I get that. And I know there are some very, very, very responsible dog owners who own Dobermans and Pit Bulls and Rottweilers and any of those dogs that can be aggressive and attack people. I know that. Maybe they got them from breeders. They know the lineage. Some of these, though, were rescues. Look, when was the last time you saw a beagle maul someone to death or an infant? They just don't. Did you ever hear of a dachshund killing anybody? Maybe it happened. I've never heard of that. Jack Russell? No. Not really. But you do hear it with Rottweilers and Dobermans and in particular Pit Bulls. That's not me saying it. It is a breed for whatever reason, whether, again, it's bred in them, it's a protective response. They see something, they perceive a child as being a danger to their owner or their handler. Listen, like I say, they're God's creatures. We don't know what's going on there. But how do you feel about this? This bill comes from Tallinn Republican Tammy Nuccio, an insurance analyst who also cares for a rescued Rottweiler, among other dogs. Well, there you go. She said the bill was intended to prevent insurance carriers from classifying entire breeds of dogs as aggressive and therefore more risky to injure, to insure. Well, why not? I don't understand. The numbers are there. Why is it if I went out and bought a brand new, the new Corvettes are gorgeous. Say I went out and spent 70 grand on a new Corvette with a big old V8 in it, 300 and something horsepower. And what if I bought a second car, I was feeling my oats, I won the lottery, and then just to zip around town in beautiful downtown Wallingford, I bought a little Toyota Corolla. Which one do you think they're going to charge me more to insure? The Corvette, all things being equal, my driving record pretty clean, haven't had a moving violation in 7 or 8 years, whatever. So I don't quite understand why we let our emotions cloud our thinking when it comes to things with animals, particularly dogs. And I know people tend to like to buy dogs that reflect their persona, whatever. That's a whole nother societal thing. But should the insurance companies be told, no, you can't set your rates based on a breed, when anybody with half a brain can go on Google right now and you can Google dog bite stats from the feds and other people around the country that clearly show that for whatever reason, whether it's a defensive move, whether it's aggressive, whether it's being protective of the owner, that there simply are some breeds that numerically, statistically, are more dangerous. I know people don't like to hear that word. But again, the maulings, the deaths are in the news on a regular basis. So a Republican, Tallinn Republican Tammy Nuccio, she wants to pass a bill that would prohibit insurance companies that write policies for homeowners, for renters, you know, dog bite policies, whatever, that would cover a dog bite. She wants to make it so you could not set the rates by the kind of breed. Why not? Why not? However, she's getting pushback on this. Rocky Hill Democrat Rep. Carrie Wood, who co-chairs the insurance panel, she was skeptical of the bill, she said. She said, quote, I need to be convinced somehow that the stories of pit bulls biting kids or even killing kids is not something that is breed-specific to certain types of dogs. She's right. Please, we love our dogs, we love our cats, but they're animals. 99.99% of the time, they will react as we want them to. But you hear of maulings. Again, another ridiculous bill. Stop it. Some of the dogs people own that may not give a whimper when they're alive are inherently, statistically, I'm not talking about emotions here, a dangerous breed. Please understand something. You may love your dog, you may love your pet, that's fine. They're animals. They're not human. And I bet you didn't know that today's opening day, huh? And you know that? No, not baseball yet. No. That's not for another couple of months. Opening day, yes. Today, for some reason, Monday, January 23rd, is the first day, opening day of the 2023 tax season. And to talk about that, a return guest, she joined us last year. She is the director of the Tax Clinic at the Quinnipiac University School of Law to tell us the stuff that we may have to keep an eye out for this year, any changes and stuff we may want to discuss with our tax preparer, our accountant. Sarah Spodek is with us. Hey, Sarah, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for hanging out with us today, Sarah. We appreciate it. You know, I have accountants in the family, Sarah, a lot of them, and I always hear from them at holidays and how they have to keep up with this change and that change, and they tell me they get all their stuff from the IRS. Hey, we're doing this differently. I guess, Sarah, a lot of people don't realize that even in a quiet year, there tend to be a lot of changes in tax law, right?
That's correct. Even during a quiet year, there are changes indeed. This year, one of the largest changes we've seen is that the Internal Revenue Service has implemented a phase-in for the new reporting requirements for PayPal and Venmo, which we all heard a lot about at the end of 2021. So what had previously was supposed to be, the programs were supposed to be issuing 1099s for individuals who receive $600 or more. Mm-hmm. That now is going to be postponed until the 2023 filing season. So that's a relief for many individuals who weren't sure what they were supposed to do with these forms.
Yeah, and these apps are becoming more and more popular, Sarah. And when somebody says to me, you know, I tell them, well, I got that $50 for you tomorrow, they say, well, just send it in my Venmo app. And I'm like, well, no, I don't have that. You're going to get cash. But apparently a lot of people do.
Yes, that's correct. And while, you know, transactions reimbursing from one another aren't taxable, what people were concerned about was that there was going to now be this reported data. We'll have to see how the service treats this in the future and if they continue to have delays in implementing this. But this is a big relief off of many individuals who have been fretting a bit what these logs are going to look like.
And the guest for a few more minutes here on Connecticut Today, Sarah Spodek. She directs the tax clinic at the Quinnipiac University School of Law, because today has been designated by the feds as January 23rd. It's the first day of the nation's 2023 tax season. Sarah, has there been any change that you know of this year or upcoming regarding incidental income? You know, somebody does a job for someone, they do a little home improvement for somebody, or they accrue some money and it's a few hundred bucks. And a lot of people always ask me, do I have to declare this or not? Where do we stand with that little incidental income that we may make on the side?
Well, you know, that income has always been required to be declared. The issue has been whether or not there's a way for the federal government to track that. So while we've all been under the obligation as United States citizens or as residents of the United States to report that income, there really hadn't been ways for individuals to have this reported on their behalf if they used, say, if they were paid via Venmo or PayPal. And that this year was supposed to kick into effect, but it has been delayed, the reporting requirements.
What about that that figure we used to see, Sarah, or is it still there? You tell me, the $600 figure. I mean, I remember a few years ago where I was paying broadcasters running an operation, and a gentleman who worked for me said, well, I never got a 1099, and I did some checking, and I found out, well, it's because he only worked like 1 or 2 days for me. Is that $600 limit or so, is that still in effect anywhere?
Well, right now, the $600 limit is definitely in effect for Venmo, PayPal, or, say, Cash App, any of these things. They will not be issuing 1099. So we've got that still in place. So this year, we're not coming in with a large change, which everybody was really nervous about. One of the reasons why individuals were really nervous, and the service itself with mm-hmm. sort of a new reporting requirement, has been that the IRS has really been operating with substantial delays still from the pandemic, and we are still seeing that to this day.
Yeah, my accountant, and he said it last year, and I haven't talked to him yet this year, but I hear that from my personal accountant, Sarah, from the accountants that call here on the show. I have a couple of local money guys and gals that call in, and they say that we're still going to see these delays, especially if you are owed a refund, right?
That's correct. Our biggest issue really is with individuals who, you know, fill out a return, they think they're doing it all correct, but they've got a little error in there. Any error, and usually these errors happen with individuals who, say, are e-filing and they don't know that their software has imported data from last year, and they don't go and correct it. Well, if it cross-checks against the computer system with the IRS and it kicks it out into some sort of error resolution, you could be in for a terrible wait. Right now, the average wait time over the year 2022 was 193 days
wow.
to resolve an error. So that's well over 6 months. So my best piece of advice going into this filing season is to remember that if you make an error on your return, it can really, really, even just a Scrivener's error, it can really delay your refund. So please watch for that.
What about, Sarah, people that may have gotten winnings, say, from gambling or sports gambling or the casino? They have to declare those, right?
That's correct. That should be issued on a 1099. You really want to wait and make sure you have all of them. Because remember, if you don't report all of your 1099 income, you could either end up in this error resolution situation where it might take you, you know, well over 6 months to come to a resolution with the IRS due to its staffing issues, or, you know, you could end up with some penalties. So important to sort of wait, even though the day is open today and you should technically be able to file everything. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, like most individuals, have not received all of their 1099s and W-2s at this point in time.
And Sarah, final question here in the few seconds we have left. What do you tell someone? You must hear this. Yeah, you know, I think I can do my taxes. It's not that complicated. I just don't want to pay an accountant. What do you tell them?
There are actually free file sites. You could go to the IRS free file website, which could help walk you through that. You could go to the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program if you make $60,000 or less, where you should be able to get some expert help. Or, you know, if you qualify for the tax counseling for the elderly, which the majority of these are operated out of the AARP programs, you could also get significant help there as well. So if you're unable to pay for a return prepare, my best advice for an individual would be to try to utilize one of these various forms of help.
Sarah Spodek directs the Tax Clinic at the Quinnipiac University School of Law. Sarah, thank you for your annual help. We appreciate it. Take care, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. There you go, folks. So make sure you file. Yes, if you won on FanDuel or DraftKings, or yes, you have to. They send it to you in the mail. I was talking to somebody the other day. Said to me, "Hey, do they know if I won that parlay?" Yes, they do. Yes, they do. They don't just pay out without squaring up with the feds. Okay, so be logical. Don't play around with your taxes. Don't. You will. How often do we talk about it on this show with Lisa in the midday, with Melissa in the morning, our top and bottom of the hour news? How often do we hear of people getting pinched for taxes, what they did 7, 8, 9, 10 years in the future? I'm sorry, in the past. It'll always shake out in the wash. The IRS has these algorithms, and like Sarah said from Quinnipiac, it takes them a while. The delays are still huge. But eventually, they all shake out. You don't want to battle the feds, especially on taxes, because they have hours and hours of billable hours available for attorneys, and they can. I don't like to use the phrase, but they can, if they want, lawyer you to death. But if you have a dispute with them, get a tax attorney and get an accountant. You set up an appointment. You go to meet at your local IRS office. And you come to an agreement, right? There you go. Not hard. And we've had this gentleman on the program numerous times. We got an offer to get him back, so we jumped on that. He is a former law enforcement officer. He's now an accomplished attorney many times, representing law enforcement officers, and also an accomplished author. LanceLaRussoBooks.com is where you want to go. LanceLaRussoBooks.com. And we welcome back attorney, author, and law enforcement advocate Lance LaRusso here to the program. Hey, Lance, it's Paul here in Connecticut again. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Well, Lance, thank you. It's always good to have you on every so often so you can give us the temperature of what's going on here. Lance, what are you hearing from law enforcement? I know you're pretty tied in. And, you know, Lance, you and I talk about, I think, the vast majority, 80, 85, 90% of the people, the silent majority here in the country, Lance. I still think we hold our police officers, our men and women, and our administrative people in high regard. We like what they do. They have a tough job. Unfortunately, that gets drowned out by the 10 or 15% who are never happy. So, current events, Lance, what can you tell us?
You know, last year was a particularly violent year for law enforcement. We had well over 300 officers shot in the line of duty. We had scores of officers ambushed, higher than in previous years. So this is not officers who were chasing someone down the street after a an armed robbery that they're chasing a suspect. They're literally just sitting in their cars and they're shot or they're ambushed on a false call that they're called to. So it's particularly violent. And what we're, you know, the only optimism other than the fact that the public generally supports law enforcement is the fact that agencies are getting funding because the public is realizing that they can't survive without the police. So we're starting to see some of these agencies receiving opportunities to pay transfer bonuses, lateral hires, and credit for time that they've been in law enforcement, longevity pay. The scary thing is, because so many people have left the profession and a lot of other people are leaving, now you have law enforcement agencies all competing in the same pool for officers that are willing to move.
Yeah, and Lance, we're in the Bridgeport, Connecticut area, and the new police chief has been put in here. And, you know, his main task, and he's been on the radio station here talking about it, is to just get the department here, you know, up to a full complement of officers with a combination of trying to recruit officers from other towns and newly enlisted officers who get out of the academy. So retention is really becoming a problem, huh?
Retention is becoming a problem, and more importantly, when you look at the operational ability of a police department and really any organization, when you start losing the elders, when you start losing the people with the 18, 20, 25 years who would stay for another 4 or 5 years because they're invested in seeing the agency do well and passing those years of knowledge they have onto a next generation, if those folks start retiring early, it's almost impossible to replace that type of institutional knowledge. Now, on the other side, we have the activists who really have no clue as to what they're doing, but they like to talk a lot, saying that we need to get rid of these older people in law enforcement, these experienced people, because they're the problem. So there is this tension, but I think that a lot of the cities that are just under siege, where people can't stand on a bus stop or they can't, you know, walk down to the grocery store without being accosted or killed, are starting to realize that police are not the problem. They're the solution. And the people that are screaming the loudest really just need to hush and let everybody else be the adult.
Lance LaRusso, the guest for a few more minutes. We like to have him on at least once or twice a year. His pulse from a national viewpoint. Lance, a law enforcement officer who turned into an attorney or became an attorney to represent his fellow brothers and sisters in law enforcement. A good fiction writer as well. Check out LanceLaRussoBooks.com. A lot of law enforcement novels that Lance has written. Lance, if you didn't become a lawyer and an attorney and an author, harken back. Do you ever ask yourself, would I still be in law enforcement? Would you have stuck it out if you didn't get the calling to go into law and to become a writer in this situation or not? What do you think?
I absolutely would have. I'm still involved in law enforcement to a large extent. And what's a really interesting thing is there is a rush from being the person that's called for help. There is a satisfaction in helping strangers and keeping them safe that's really driving the people who are wearing badges, whether they're police officers, firefighters, EMTs, that some people in the general public just don't understand. You know, we have people saying, God, I'd never do that job because it's dangerous. But, you know, still they show up for work every day in the most horrible cities where they're maligned and cursed at and shot at. They still put those uniforms on and show up every day. And that's the reason why we need to respect them. We need to thank them when we see them out. And I appreciate you calling the attention to what they're going through.
Lance, what about the messaging coming from D.C.? You know, since the change of administration, you have Mr. Biden in there, who's whether you like the guy or not, he does hearken from another era of Democratic politics that looked for and championed the law enforcement union endorsement. You know, you have a lot of Democrats in the House now in the minority, but a lot of them are saying, hey, this defund the police thing is killing us. We lost our majority here, and we better straighten up here. But still, there are those who are sticking to that in some of the hardcore areas here, Lance. What do you see from a distance as far as the change in D.C. right now?
Well, from the 10,000-foot view, I think the chants, the global and loud chants for defund the police that we were seeing have largely been silenced. as you said, except for a couple of outliers. Now, whether they've been silenced because they realized they were idiotic to begin with and ill-informed, you know, defund the police is the fastest conceived, implemented, and failed social policy in U.S. history. But whether they're doing it because of that or whether they're doing it because it didn't work and politically it's not expedient, I don't know. But I can say that from talking to some of the people who have recently been elected, I'm very encouraged that they understand the role of law enforcement, and more importantly, they understand the relationship between law enforcement and a safe and prosperous society. And if you don't have law enforcement there, for all of the aspirational goals that we don't need law enforcement if people just learn to get along and learn conflict resolution, that doesn't cut it when the Chamber of Commerce can't recruit new businesses to the city.
Lance, one thing I know that is driving people crazy around here in the Northeast in Connecticut, it must drive law enforcement men and women like yourself nuts who put their lives on the line out there to get a suspect and then have him or her booked, is this no cash or low cash bail, which is wreaking havoc in New York City, which is coming to Illinois now, although it's been put on hold, thankfully, by a court there. I mean, look, we don't want to keep people with unreasonable bail for breaking a window or stealing a candy bar. But this is just nuts, Lance, from what I've read and from what police officers tell me.
You know, generally, if you look throughout the United States, you'll find that the Eighth Amendment obviously has to control. So excessive bail cannot be required. But what you'll find is a legislative scheme in just about every state. Some it's constitutional, some it's just statutes that are on the books, that people should be granted bail unless there is a reason not to. Generally, those reasons are they have a propensity to be a danger to society. They're going to threaten witnesses. They may hamper the prosecution. Now, when you look at the person who commits a low-level crime and they have not been involved in criminal action before, there's never been a bar to those folks getting bail. The question is whether or not they could make the bail. But courts have the authority to work with them to provide bail. What you are seeing is this across-the-board blanket no-bail policy with people, contrary to what I just outlined, who are a danger to themselves and others, who are a danger to witnesses, who are going to intimidate people who might be involved in the prosecution, and who also have violent histories. They have shown themselves to not be the person who mistakenly wound up involved in a crime. They have a pattern of criminal, antisocial, dangerous behavior. Those people should not be allowed out to roam the streets until their cases are adjudicated. That is one of the fundamental roles of the court system, is to ensure someone's appearance for the adjudication of their case. And if you've shown over and over again you have a violent propensity, you're going to intimidate witnesses, and you won't show up to court, then they shouldn't get bail, or the bail should be set high enough to ensure their appearance.
And Lance, finally, I can't imagine how infuriated men and women are like yourself in law enforcement who may put themselves on the line in a dangerous or semi-dangerous situation to nab these people. They bring them back to the station house. They get booked. They go before a judge later on that day or night or in a couple of days, and they get bailed out. And I can't tell you the number of officers I've talked to, men and women, who say, yeah, I put my rear end on the line, and 3 days later, he's back on the street. I mean, I can't understand how that must make law enforcement officers feel.
Well, I'll let you know a little secret. One of the things that really upsets them about it is they go into communities that are terrorized by criminals. Mm. They make a case, they arrest the person, and then that person gets out on no cash bail, and they know that the public that they have been sworn to protect, the people that looked at them with wide eyes and said, thank you for bringing this person out of our community, are scared to death now because they can't walk outside their doors when that person comes back. And they were not even given a cash bail.
Lance, always good stuff. Check out the website, folks, LanceLaRussoBooks.com, LanceLaRussoBooks.com. Lance, thank you. Take care, and we'll talk down the road in a few months. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. There you go, folks. Law enforcement officer, lawyer, author of many books, and you can hear he's passionate about his fellow men and women. Lance, LaRusso, LaRusso, Books.com. Com. All right. Good folks. We talk about them all the time when they have fundraisers or other activities of the Connecticut Hockey Foundation. We had one over the weekend that was centered around an ongoing charitable event that they hold. And this year it was showcased at the brand new Martiri Family Arena at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Eric Open, area attorney and very active in the Hockey Foundation, joins us to talk about it. Eric, my friend, good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing great, Paul. A little cold, but always so great to be on the air.
Eric, you're breaking up just a little bit. So
are you there?
Yeah.
Hi, Paul. Is that better?
Yes, that's much better. What did you do?
Okay, I'm up in the woods in Avon, Connecticut right now, actually. Literally on the, so it,
yeah.
We've been trying to move things around, so hopefully that's better.
No, that's whatever you did, Eric, it sounds great. So the charitable activities of the Connecticut Hockey Foundation, stuff you did this past weekend, how folks can further help, give us an update as to what's going on here.
Well, as you said, we held our annual fundraiser, and it just as a little background and memory of, we're a 501c3 formed in 2016 in memory of the late Jason Pagney, who was a Connecticut hockey icon. Avon Old Farms graduate, coached Menard, numerous National Hockey League and prep school, and advocated at all grassroots levels. And we did several fundraiser games for his two daughters' education funds after his passing in 2014, and turned into a foundation with a lot of help from our great friend CJ Maritola, who you know very well, was a close friend of Sacred Heart. And today we've awarded $9,000 in grants to deserving, youth hockey players who tell compelling, we have compelling situations. And Saturday night was about, replenishing the coffins, and we had the privilege of doing it at the Martiri Arena, which, as any of your listeners, I'm sure you've said, Paul, you've got to see this place to believe it. And what I can tell you is that it was our best night ever. We had a silent auction with game tickets directly from Boston Bruins manager Don Sweeney, two tickets from Chris Drury, paraphernalia, kids stuff, contributions. We're active on Twitter at CT Hockey FDN and also a Venmo page. So that's a little bit of it. It was a wonderful evening. It was, I know you were doing the game. It was a packed house. It just, we're tallying our numbers, but suffice to say, it was our best night ever.
Yeah, and again, you can go to the Twitter page. Great pictures, great info. The Connecticut Hockey Foundation, CT Hockey FDN on Twitter, and Eric Open. This is a, just because you had your big fundraiser this weekend, you do take contributions year round, correct? How can people get a hold of you if they just want to make a donation any time of the year and feel the spirit to do so?
Well, you can go to our foundation and direct mail, message us at CT Hockey FDN. We also have the same Venmo page. Anybody who makes a contribution, we're happy to give them a 501c3 certificate. We are a tax-free exempt organization, and to date, we just want to continue Jason's legacy on a sustained basis for, the family, his friends up here at Avon Old Farms and throughout the hockey community. And if you talk to anybody who knew Jason Pagney, everybody had a story.
Excellent. So once again, go to the Venmo page or the Twitter page, CT Hockey FDN, the Connecticut Hockey Foundation. They take donations year long, and they just finished their big weekend of fundraising, and part of the money goes to help Jason's children continue with their education in his memory.
Right, and we're going to be doing a grant cycle, Paul, starting this spring. This is going to allow us to do the things, and maybe one of these donees at some point will become a story of a Jason Pagney legacy. So we're thrilled to continue the cycle of grant awards.
All right. Eric Open, my friend, good to see you. I'm sure I'll run into you maybe this weekend. Who knows? Eric, take care. Be good up in the hinterlands there in the beautiful scenic part of Connecticut. Watch for the deer and the moose and drive safely, okay?
Oh, tell me, we all have to watch for the deer. They're the scariest things in my neck of the woods. They like my backyard sometimes. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. And thanks to listening.
No problem, Eric. Appreciate that. See you at the rink. Attorney Eric Open there helps run the Connecticut Hockey Foundation, CTHOCKEYFDN. They did their annual fundraiser in the memory of Jason Pagney, who was very instrumental in coaching a lot of young men, particularly at Avon Old Farms, many of whom went on to play higher levels of hockey. And now the annual efforts there by the foundation go to help Jason's daughters and other people associated with the great game.